From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I didn't know nothing about it, man. After I got through recording, the funny thing, I'd never heard myself talk. I didn't know what I sound like, you know, singing. So when they got ready to play it back, I said to one of the guys, when are you going to play the one we just finished? And it was us already. I had Ben Branch on tenor saxophone. You probably heard that name, Ben Branch, because he worked a lot with Operation Push family. And I had a lady trombonist named Sammy Jett. And the trumpet player was Ben Branch's brother, Thomas Branch. And I had the finest Newbans. People later started to call him Phineas, but finest Newbans, that's what it was. I had finest Newbans on keyboard, his brother Calvin on guitar, his father on drums, so Finest Senior, Finest Junior, and his brother on guitar. And the bass player was Tuff Green, who was the band leader. And that was my first recording.
Blues legend B.B. King. King considered one of the greatest guitarists of all time and the father of rock and roll. He recorded more than 50 albums during his seven-decade career. In 1984, he was inducted into the Blues Foundation Hall of Fame and into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987. Also, King is a 15-time Grammy Award winner. He received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 1987 and a Grammy Hall of Fame Award in 1998. King's first big break came in 1948 when he performed on the Sonny Boy Williamson's radio program on KWEM. This led to a steady engagement at the 16th Avenue Grill in West Memphis and later to a 10-minute spot on Memphis radio station WDIA. King's spot became so popular it was expanded and became the Sepia Swing Club. Soon King needed a catchy radio name. What started out as Bill Street Blues Boy was shortened to Blues Boy King and eventually B.B. King. King's middle initial B is just that. It is not an abbreviation. King was self-taught and named every guitar he used Lucille after an incident at a dance hall in Arkansas where a fire broke out after two men were fighting over a woman with that name. On May 14, 2015, King died. He was 89. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the legendary B.B. King in Black America.
3 days of snow.
Back in 1949, I used to play this place in Twist, Arkansas. Twist, Arkansas, for people that are not familiar with it, is about 45 miles northwest of Memphis, Tennessee. So I used to play there, four-walling, as they call it, you know, for what money I could get coming in. I used to play there quite often, especially weekends. And it used to get quite cold in Twist. And when it did get cold, they'd take something like a big garbage pail, set it in the middle of the dance floor, half fill it with kerosene, they would light that fuel, and that's what we use for heat. The building was not that large. It was about, you could get about 200 people in there chugged in. But sometimes during the run of a night, we may have 300 or 400 people because they come in and go out. Anyway, with this container sitting in the middle of the floor burning, we used it for heat, but people danced around and never disturbed it. But one night, two guys started fighting, and one knocked the other one over on this container. When they did, it spilled on the floor. When it spilled on the floor, already burning, it looked like a river of fire. Everybody started running for the front door, including B.B. King. Back door was nailed up. Keep people from sneaking in. You know about this place. Anyway, when I got on the outside, then I realized I'd left my guitar.
At the age of 12, B.B. King purchased his first guitar for $15. He was inspired to play the guitar after seeing his pastor play in church. King began singing in a gospel choir at church, but the blues took root in him during his teen years. King dropped out of high school in the 10th grade and spent much of his early years picking cotton and working as a tractor driver. After a short stint in the Army during World War II, he returned home to work as a farmer, but a tractor accident prompted him to give up that life and start another in Memphis. There, he officially launched his musical career in the late 1940s. Born Riley B. King on September 16, 1925 in Mississippi, King entered the music industry as a disc jockey in Memphis, Tennessee. In 1949, he began his recording career and had his first hit 3 years later entitled 3 O'Clock Blues. In 1969, across-the-board stardom finally came to King when he crashed the mainstream consciousness in a big way with The Thrill Is Gone. The song was an R&B sensation, and it vaulted to the upper reaches of the pop charts. During his seven-decade career, he was known as the King of the Blues. In 1995, In Black America sat down with the 15-time Grammy Award winner before an Austin City Limits taping.
You know, to be honest with you, I never thought that I would be a blues singer, period. I started out to be a gospel singer, never to be a blues singer. But the tips on the streets when people would request a gospel tune, they usually would, you know, thank me very politely, pat me on the shoulders and say, keep it up, son, you're going to be good one day, but they didn't tip. People asked me to sing a blues, would always tip me and offer me a beer or something. So that's how I really started in. But I thought I would be popular as a gospel singer, but not to the, the way it is today.
I also understand you spent some time behind the mic as a disc jockey.
Well, you said it right, behind the mic. To be a disc jockey like you guys is so much different. The automation and everything, you know. You push in a CD or something, and the machine cues it up for all you guys. I had to have what they call Ampex 600s, and you had reel-to-reel. Mm-hmm. So I was no disc jockey. I was just a guy, as you said, sitting behind the microphone.
Once you decided or made the switch or figured out that you can probably make more money or live in playing blues than gospel, what gave you the impetus to really put forth the effort to be a great blues and guitarist?
Well, I guess being the Virgo that I am, whatever I do, I try to do the best that I can do. And I got lucky. I got a manager, which I think is the best in the world for me, named Sid Seidenberg, and then got a great record company, MCA, a great agency associated, and great public relations people, and the greatest band ever for me, and a little talent myself, and I think all that together made a pretty good good ingredients, you know. So that made me, you know, feel like I was kind of on the way.
For those who are listeners that don't know the story of how you happened to name your guitar Lucille, could you tell us that story?
It seems so far back, and having these pretty ladies around me, you're really messing things up for me today. Back in 1949, I used to play this place in Twist, Arkansas. Twist, Arkansas, for people that are not familiar with it, is about 45 miles northwest of Memphis, Tennessee. So I used to play there, four-walling, as they call it, you know, for what money I could get coming in. I used to play there quite often, especially weekends. And it used to get quite cold in Twist. And when it did get cold, they'd take something like a big garbage pail, set it in the middle of the dance floor, half fill it with kerosene, and they would light that fuel, and that's what we use for heat. The building was not that large. It was about, you could get about 200 people in there chugged in. But sometimes during the run of a night, we may have 300 or 400 people because they come in and go out. Anyway, with this container sitting in the middle of the floor burning, we used it for heat, but people danced around and never disturbed it. But one night, two guys started fighting, and one knocked the other one over on this container. When they did, it spilled on the floor. When it spilled on the floor, already burning, it looked like a river of fire. Everybody started running for the front door, including B.B. King. Back door was nailed up.
Okay.
Keep people from sneaking in. You know about those places. Anyway, when I got on the outside, then I realized I'd left my guitar. I went back for it. When I did, the building was a wooden building, burning rapidly, and started to collapse around me. So I almost lost my life trying to save my guitar. The next morning, we found that these two guys was fighting about a lady that worked in the little nightclub. I never did meet her, but I learned that her name was Lucille. I named my guitar Lucille to remind me never to do a thing like that again. Think you can get another guitar, but not another B.B. King.
How did you happen to come up with that B.B. King sound, that certain thrill you have when you pick your guitar?
When I was a young guy in school, I used to stammer a lot. My teacher used to set me down and say, wait, B, you got time. So I think that when I started to play, my thoughts along the line of taking my time saying what I said was the same thing on playing the guitar. It's sort of like a story I once heard about some animals. There was these animals that could climb a tree, was up eating grapes. If Bucks came along later and saw him up there and said, "Hey, guy, throw down some grapes. See, if you want some grapes, climb up and get them." Fox knew he couldn't climb, so he said, "Well, that's all right. They're probably sour anyway." So that's the way I was about speed playing. I could never play very fast, get my ideas to work, so I think that I practiced quality, not quantity.
That first recording date that you had in the studio?
I didn't know nothing about it, man. After I got through recording, the funny thing, I'd never heard myself talk. I didn't know what I sound like, you know, singing. So when they got ready to play it back, I said to one of the guys, I said, "When are you gonna play the one we just finished?" And it was us already. I had Ben Branch on tenor saxophone. You probably heard that name, Ben Branch, because he worked a lot with Operation Push. Mm-hmm. Band leader, and I had a lady, a trombonist named Sammy Jett, and the trumpet player was Ben Branch's brother, Thomas Branch, and I had the finest Newbans. People later started to call him Phineas, but finest Newbun, that's what it was. I had finest Newbun on keyboard, his brother Calvin on guitar, his father on drums, so it was finest senior, finest junior, and his brother on guitar, and the bass player was Tough Green,
okay,
who was the band leader. And that was my first recording. So you see, I didn't have just two, three people, pieces like some people seem to think.
Mm-hmm.
I had a full band the first time I recorded.
Being from Detroit, I used to sneak in and hear you play at Phelps Lounge. But since that time, you've grown in popularity and you're playing big concert halls. Do you still get the intimacy with the crowd playing in large venues?
Oh yes, more so in a way, because usually now the equipment, the sounds is better.
Okay.
It's so funny that you would say that in the larger halls. I remember reading a piece from Mr. Wilson that used to write for the New York Times, and he said, "B.B. King, 25 overnight success." Now, B.B. King, 25-year overnight success. And it sounds sort of funny, but what he was talking about all the other nights that I played was in the small places like Phelps Lounge, okay, and so on. So finally, we decided that we could make it in some of the larger venues, and it's been good.
Do you find the young artists still have an appreciation for the blues, particularly African-American artists? Are we losing something that has been ours over the decades?
Well, to be honest with you, I never really had it.
Okay.
I never had it from the beginning. The young blacks, when I started out, was my age and older, which was my fans. Usually they was my age and older. So when I was 18, they were 18. As I grew older, they grew older. Now it's a few of them, a very small amount of Afro-Americans that seem to still, I'm talking about that's younger.
Okay.
That seems, when you mention blues, to them, I guess it's like, it almost like being black, mentioning black.
Right, okay.
But to be a blues player, you like being black twice.
Okay.
You know, you're black because you are black, and then you're black because you sing the blues, which puts you another strike below.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me sad, though, because as I travel all over the world, I find that the people, not only Caucasian, Asians, any place that we go, usually are quite happy to see us, happy to hear about us. But it's sort of sad to me from time to time. Even my own children, I talk to them about it sometime. I remember once I took one of my sons to see the movie Lady Day.
Okay.
And so he was very sad coming back and said, did that really happen? Would people live like that? I said, boy, you living like that now, right now, you know. And then I didn't really hold it against him because I figured that maybe I've slipped somewhere. I didn't tell him all the things maybe I should have. One of the sad things that bothered me now, it's almost like it's across the board, like if you and I was getting ready to sing a piece and we said, one, two, three, play, you know. If I go to any hotel, any city, and usually when I meet an Afro-American, a young Afro-American, oh, my mother's gonna die. I see B.B. King. My father's gonna die. What about him? You know, so you get this. I get it in every city. I get it every place I go. And I finally start to learn that they're not really putting me down, or they don't mean to put me down, but what they're saying does. And so it sort of hurts, but now I've started to think of it this way. This is their way of saying to me that they have family members that like me. But usually the whites and the other ethnic groups of different colors, they will say, ah, B.B. King, may I have your autograph, please? Okay. Afro-American, may I have one for my mother, please? My grandmother just loves you. Give me one of those. Uh-huh. Sort of hurts that you seem like you're loved by everybody else except your own people.
Okay. You've jammed with any number of musicians. What have been the most enjoyable performances you've had?
Well, that's sort of hard, and you will get me in trouble to even answer. But I'll try.
Okay.
One of my greatest experiences has been jamming, and has been with my dear friend and my favorite singer, Bobby Bland. I think that'd get me out of trouble.
Well, that was a good live recording.
Yeah, thanks. It's so funny, though. When we first recorded together for the first time, we had a critic to write, I think it was the Rolling Stone, and he said, whatever we were doing before we did that, we should go back and start doing it again. And not long after that, the album went platinum. So I wrote them and told them, whoever that critic was, use him on the next album to criticize the next one, because obviously, his words was, you know, in reverse of what really was.
3 o'clock in the morning, and I can't even close my eyes. I can't find my baby. I can't be satisfied.
You have a club in Memphis. What brought you to the point to open a nightclub to spotlight blues artists?
Well, in Memphis, when I left Mississippi, I was told then and still believe today that Memphis is the home of the blues.
Okay.
Now, they talk about Chicago and all the other places, but to me, Memphis is the home of the blues, and I didn't do like some of my friends that went to different places. I didn't go north, I just went to Memphis because I found that all of the facilities that I needed to record and to make it, if you will, was in Memphis. Well, I used to walk Beale Street then, and there used to be a record shop right there where our club is today, called the Home of the Blues. And I used to go in there quite often and wonder, you know, how could I do things? What would happen? Would it ever happen? And I worked about 7 miles, in other words, I lived about 7 miles, it seemed, at least 5 miles where I lived, and I'd have to walk to town to my job at that time. And sometimes I had two jobs, on the radio and this other job. And then sometimes I pick cotton. I had three jobs just to try to keep things, make ends meet, if you will. So when we did start to renovate, or when they started to renovate Beale Street, one of the thoughts were, would a club do any good there? Because they had a lot of, would one do good of B.B. King? So we got some investors, and along with myself and my manager, and we all went in and came up with the B.B. King Blues Club. Today we have two. We've got one in Hollywood, and we've just broken ground for a third one in Nashville. They've been going well.
How do you go about writing the songs in which you perform, and also what have been some of the songs you particularly enjoy performing?
Believe it or not, I wrote a lot of songs, but I never thought that they were, you know, I didn't think of myself as a writer. I've written, I guess, 150 or 200 songs more. I don't do much writing today. It seemed like to me now, everybody that's writing are writing something that I would have asked them to write had I knew they were going to write it, you know. I find so many people writing so many good songs, I just love them, but I don't even know the people. I just hear the song and say, yes, that one, that's it. How do I write? It's after times like now. I've met you and you got me fired up talking, and I see the beautiful ladies over there, and the surrounding is beautiful, so on my way home or my way to the hotel or something, beautiful thoughts come in my mind. Then some other times, I mean, I went to the place where it wasn't so nice. I have thoughts about that too, you know, those things. So it's, or in bed sometime, you might wake up with a thought or an idea. It's like you sometimes probably, a melody will come in your head, or something you whistle or hum. You don't know what it is, where you got it from, but that's what you do. So that's what happens to me when I'm writing.
Sometimes I wonder just what am I fighting for? I win some battles, but I always lose the war. I keep right on stumbling, and there's no man's land out here, but I know. Yes, I know there must be a better world somewhere.
Any advice you would give to young artists and young African Americans of what it takes to succeed in life?
Well, I've found that you do what you enjoy doing. Don't do it simply because somebody wants you to do it or you get paid to do it. Do it because you enjoy doing it. Fast money in an illegal way doesn't stay with you. You may make money on top of money, but eventually you get busted. And once you get busted, and if it's drugs, they take all your money, all your property, everything you had, and a little bit that you might have hidden in your shoebox. When the government or the authorities get through with you, then the lawyers get the rest of it. So you wind up with nothing. I know I've had a couple of family members that's been involved in it, and I know what happened, which I told them the same thing I'm telling the people on your show now. The best way, there is no limit now to what Afro-Americans can do. It used to be you couldn't go to school here because somebody's standing in the door, so you can't have an education here. That's not anymore. Today you can get it. Go ahead and get that education. Major in music or computers or something, but major in your music and mine in something else, or take two majors if you have to, but get the education. Education is one thing no one can take away from you. The more popular I get, today, I have to say this to you. I'm in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, as a star in Hollywood. I'm in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I've been honored with the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. I've been honored with the Handy Achievement Award. I've got I think it's 5 honorary doctorate degrees, one from Tupelo College in Mississippi. I was honored at Ole Miss. They don't usually give you an honorary degree, but they honor you, which is similar. But I have honorary degrees from Tougaloo, honorary degrees from Rogue College, from Berklee School of Music, and from Yale. But out of all of these honorary degrees, and the many things that have happened that honors me, I still miss the education I didn't get. I still think about the people that are going to college today or was going then when I was missing school and sacrificing them to trying to do what I'm doing. Today, I wished I had. I would give up a whole lot of this just to have that education. So I say to them, an education no one can take from you. If you got an education, you'll learn how to make money. You will learn how to make living. You'll learn how to make things better for not only you, but your surroundings. Education helped to do that. I think the world today, the one thing that we need more than anything else is education. Because I personally think that the educational would be the answer to most of the problems we have today. So I would say to this young person, if you have gone to school and you're in college, finish. If you haven't, you still have a chance. And when you get to play your instrument, don't try to play like B.B. King, Eric Clapton, Kenny Burrell, or whomever if you're playing guitar, but learn the rudiments, learn all the progression, learn it all, then you can play like yourself. And then if somebody comes to town and wants you to play blues, play it. They want you to play jazz, play it, because you can. So I would say to them, practice hard, study hard. The world today is yours. You will make your mark in history. I'm talking to the young people. Make your mark in history. The world have survived for a long time, and it will survive with or without you. But you can help it be so much better.
Now, Father Time is catching up with me. Gone is my youth. I look in the mirror every day, and let it tell me the truth. I'm singing the blues. I just have to sing the blues.
This has been a tribute to the late B.B. King. King died on May 14, 2015. He was 89. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions after future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 1 University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 1 University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.